For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. The House of Representatives recently voted to reauthorize the FISA Amendments Act, a law originally passed in 2008 that subjects American citizens to the government's vast warrantless wiretapping program. Most Americans don't know that their international calls and emails are subject to this program. Even their domestic emails and phone calls can be picked up without a warrant from the judge. The law's proponents don't seem to know this either. Julian Sanchez is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and journalist who covers the intersection of privacy, technology, and politics. He works as a research fellow at the Libertarian Cato Institute and is a contributing editor for Reason magazine. He also writes for The Economist's Democracy in America blog. He is the former Washington editor for the technology news site Ars Technica. Julian Sanchez, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. I thought I'd start by asking you to tell me, what is FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and how did it change after 9/11?
Sure. So the original FISA was passed in 1978 in response to a series of scandals about the abuse of intelligence power. Of course, Richard Nixon was perhaps the most notorious abuser of intelligence surveillance for political purposes, but an investigation spearheaded by Senator Frank Church turned up essentially decades worth of evidence of the misuse of surveillance authority by the FBI, CIA, and NSA for essentially political purposes. Most infamously, of course, they bugged the hotel rooms of Martin Luther King and then tried to use the audio tapes of his extramarital liaisons to drive him to suicide. There was a plan to replace him with what the Bureau called, the FBI called, the right kind of Negro leader who would be controlled by the FBI. So after all this came out, of course, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed to create a legal architecture for intelligence surveillance. Before, it had sort of been taken for granted that for foreign intelligence, the kind of American criminal justice approach, involving judicial warrants, wasn't necessary. The president sort of had power in this sphere. The scandals and the revelation of those scandals made it clear that something more than that was necessary. Some kind of oversight was necessary, and so the FISA Act established the secret, highly classified Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which would be, basically all of its operations would be under tight seal, but it would have a mechanism with a slightly looser standard that would let intelligence agencies get warrants for electronic surveillance. And there was a pretty clear divide here, which was that at least if you were picking something up off a wire in the United States, and one end of that was an American, you would need a warrant. But if you were picking up totally foreign communications that just happened to pass through the United States, that was a kind of no holds barred. There was no warrant requirement there because people overseas weren't protected by the Fourth Amendment.
Right. So warrants for Americans, no warrant needed for foreigners. Mm-hmm. But right. Was the standard for that warrant also looser?
It was a little bit looser because for a criminal warrant, you need to be able to prove that. Essentially the surveillance will, you have probable cause to believe that this surveillance will turn up evidence of a crime. And the standard's a little looser. In FISA, it's that you have to have probable cause to believe that the target of the surveillance is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. And so it's a sort of more permissive standard. You don't necessarily have to have strong evidence that they are actively doing something criminal. It's enough essentially to show that they are somehow being employed by or working for some kind of foreign power, which includes a foreign terror group. Also, the way the surveillance operates is a bit looser. For criminal surveillance, they're really supposed to listen kind of in real time and figure out. So if they've got a mob boss's phone line, for example, they're supposed to just listen, make sure they're picking up calls that are relevant to a criminal activity, but they're not supposed to be listening in if, the target's wife is on the phone to her doctor, or if, the teenage children are talking. They're supposed to monitor it to make sure they really very narrowly only get the particular information they're looking for. FISA surveillance is substantially broader. They usually just sort of sweep up everything on the target lines and go through it and minimize, as they call it, removing the extraneous stuff later. And so for basically several decades until 9/11, that was the structure that there was a system allowing basically unrestricted surveillance of totally foreign stuff. But if someone you were interested started communicating with an American, the idea was at that point you needed sort of specific judicial approval because now you were actually encroaching on the privacy rights and the Fourth Amendment rights of someone in the United States. And then, of course, shortly after 9/11, we know President Bush authorized the NSA to begin effectively ignoring FISA, authorized them to begin intercepting international communication, at least. There seems to have been more than this that is not well known, but the part that was revealed by the New York Times involves both a combination of data mining and warrantless surveillance of international communications involving Americans or people in the United States, which, again, under the law clearly required a warrant, which he chose not to acquire for whatever reason.
Tell us about the technology for that. Recently there was a long piece in The New Yorker, I think it was Jane Meyer writing about Thomas Drake, who worked for the National Security Agency at the time, right after 9/11. He helped design this program, what you referred to as data mining, which I'm not sure I completely understand, and maybe you can explain it to me. And then also William Binney has spoken about it as well. And I'm trying to understand how this surveillance is actually conducted and how broad it is in terms of this technology.
I mean, so of course we have to speculate a little bit. There's, obviously there's traditional phone surveillance, but there's also internet surveillance of electronic communications, which work a little bit differently. The internet is a packet switch network, so you have essentially a huge pipe containing millions of both domestic and international communications. Know that they had the NSA had installed at several telecommunications hub, thanks to a whistleblower who formerly worked for AT&T, a device called a NORA Semantic Analyzer, which is basically an incredibly powerful computer that took the entire fiber optic feed of internet traffic going through that AT&T building and sifted through it. And we're not sure exactly how the sifting works. We know that they have the NSA has, for example, moderately sophisticated voice recognition capabilities. So one way, one thing they might have been trying to do is you don't always necessarily know what phone a clever target is going to be using. So one way to do that is to try to do voice matching. It's also possible that they were doing keyword analysis of some kind to see if keywords or phrases they knew were being used or believed at least were being used by their targets, in emails, but also, other kinds of data mining that involve looking for patterns where you don't necessarily know who the target is, but you notice that, calls from Los Angeles to Yemen take place at a certain time or a phone number that is making a certain pattern of suspicious international calls might send a flag. And it seems like something like this is what was going on. They were using pattern analysis, looking at patterns of communications between known targets overseas and people in the United States, and then just sort of general criteria of communications activity that they determined was suspicious in order to try and, preempt, a future attack. It looks after the fact as though this was not very effective. We're speculating to some extent about what exactly was involved, but it's been described by enough different people in loose terms that it sounds like something like this is what was going on. At the time, we were told that this was an absolutely necessary program that was saving American lives and preventing terrorist attacks. It became clear years later, through a series of both leaks that were reported in the press, but then also ultimately in 2008 because of a essentially a joint audit by the inspectors general of the major intelligence agencies that really concluded that this was a program that had generated mostly dead ends. It had, essentially FBI agents complained that they had been sent on a lot of wild goose chases. The problem is that when you're trying to filter through billions of communications looking for the needle in the haystack, you're going to get a lot more false positives because actual terrorists are pretty rare. It's one of those old statistics puzzles, right? If you have a test, even if you have a test that's 99% accurate, if the thing you're looking for is one in a million, you're going to get a hugely larger number of false positives than real hits. And it looks like that's what happened here, that they intercepted many, many thousands of people's communications without a whole lot to show for it. However, in 2008, it was decided, and President Obama voted for the FISA Amendments Act after initially pledging to filibuster it, that they needed to provide immunity for the telecom that had essentially exposed themselves to civil lawsuits because they were participating in this illegal program, but also to establish a kind of legalized version of it, where the FISA court is now involved again, but only in a very general way. So the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence now, instead of needing a warrant, so if they are specifically targeting an American person, so if you are an American citizen in Boston and they want to tap your personal phone line, the traditional FISA process still applies. They need to show a judge probable cause that you are an agent of some foreign power. But for foreign targets, and this gets a bit tricky, they can authorize these broad surveillance programs where the court just signs off on general procedures, targeting procedures to ensure that the surveillance has a foreign target. So in theory, this is supposed to mean that they are able to keep listening to the conversations, reading the emails of people overseas that they're trying to spy on or spy on their communications as they pass through the United States. Now, one problem is that given the scale at which the NSA operates, they're sweeping in billions of communications every day, and given the kind of blunderbuss approach it seems like they may have been taking, they sort of suck up everything and figure out later what it is that you need to look at. The foreign target requirement, not a huge limitation, because it's not that they're required to target foreign terrorists. The program has to be aimed at gathering foreign intelligence, but it just says, the target has to be overseas. It doesn't say the target has to be an overseas person you suspect as being a terrorist. So if they think, for example, Al-Qaeda or some other group they don't like is operating...
WikiLeaks, you suggested in one piece.
Or WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is certainly a foreign group that is engaged in activities that have intelligence value to the United States, that someone is likely to think is information relevant to foreign intelligence purposes. Any foreign group. But they could decide, this group is operating out of Sweden or out of Karachi, and so we will just broadly sweep in all communications from that region, for example, that are flowing through the United States. It's broad enough that that you're likely to end up with, or at least it's potentially broad enough, the law allows it to be broad enough, you could have a huge number of Americans' international communications swept into, especially when you consider that on the Internet, you may not even be aware that you're having an international communication.
I want to ask you, so for example, if I decide I want to download something from the WikiLeaks website, for example, would that kind of communication be, would that bit of information be recorded somewhere?
It could be. That's the trouble with the book of this is that if...
It's broad, yep.
So they've decided that one of their targets is WikiLeaks. Within the scope of the law, it would certainly be, permissible for them to have that program and say, all right, we're sweeping in all data about communications to or from WikiLeaks servers and the computers of people known to be affiliated with WikiLeaks. And so, you would expect they would record, for example, people who are visiting that website, and that would go into the sort of pool of data to be mined later to try and tease out, you know, who might be an affiliate in the United States.
Julian Sanchez, are we also talking about, when you were talking about, wiretapping of phones, we're not talking about traditional wiretaps here, are we? Because people mainly use cell phones, so are we talking these days? So are we talking about cell phones? Are we talking about text messages? What kinds of communications get sucked up?
About internet, we're talking about email, we're talking about text messages, we're talking about traditional phone calls also. It really sort of runs the gamut. And you know, one of the concerns here is that, you know, I've been discussing targets so far and talking about groups, which is under FISA basically how it works, right? They are not, I mean, sort of by the nature of these programs, they are not targeting individual people. They're targeting categories of targets. So WikiLeaks or, people who fit a certain profile of suspicion. And one side effect of that is that if they're targeting an email account, for example, in the United States, or if they're not targeting, but if they're intercepting an email account in the United States, if it's not an email account that they know in advance belongs to an American citizen, the fact that it is a Google account or a Yahoo account doesn't really stop them from acquiring its contents, because they can still say, well, our target is the foreign organization. Our target is WikiLeaks. This is an email address that has been in communication with WikiLeaks. If we do not know a particular American citizen is the owner of it, then sort of presumptively as part of targeting WikiLeaks, we can sweep that in also.
And what happens to it after it's picked up? Where does it go?
Everything goes into a massive NSA database. I believe it's called Pinwheel. The databases associated with this surveillance program seem to all have sort of oddly nautical names.
The National Security Agency we're talking about.
Right. So the National Security Agency maintains a database that's believed to be called Pinwheel. They are fast filling up their massive stores and so are currently building in Utah, an enormous data storage facility to hold on to all these enormous reams of data that they're sucking up. And it seems as though basically what happens is they sweep things in very broadly, and then the information that is collected sits there basically indefinitely, because you never know what might turn out to be something you wish you had saved in the future. One side effect of this is that it seems as though even the NSA does not really know what they have. Senator Ron Wyden repeatedly, for a ballpark estimate, how many Americans are affected by this? How many Americans' communications do you have in this database? Can you do a statistical sample? Give us a rough estimate. And the NSA has sort of steadfastly refused to say anything. Ironically said it would violate the privacy of Americans for them to go through the database and figure out how many Americans they have in the database.
Right. Glenn Greenwald pointed that out recently, that that kind of statement flips notions of civil liberties on their head. Instead of citizen privacy and government transparency, we have a transparent citizenry and a secret government.
Which is, of course, a historically pretty dangerous situation. And in a way, I think this is more dangerous than the scenario we saw in the 60s and 70s that gave rise to FISA originally. Because there, we saw certain illegal surveillance of many particular targets, civil rights activists, anti-war activists, women's rights activists. But at least, in some sense, that was relatively targeted. That is, the surveillance was at least limited to people who at the time had for whatever reason, got on the wrong side of J. Edgar Hoover. The surveillance now is so broad, again, because I think the idea is you need to collect everything or collect very broadly, and then you will figure out later when you put the puzzle together which communications you actually need to have a human being examine. But the result of this is that you've got, I think admittedly, you know, they would admit, an enormous quantity of mostly innocent communications sitting in a database indefinitely, but not limited to people that are somehow under the microscope now for any specific reason, you know, individually. It means that it's very likely that, you know, your communications could be swept into it, not because they have any particular interest in you, but that information is then there and available in 10 or 15 or 20 years when we now have to trust not just that the people running NSA now are, you know, decent and scrupulous about respecting the civil liberties of Americans, but that in 5, 10, 15, or 20 years, everyone with access to this data will be just as scrupulous, will not be tempted, as essentially every administration, you know, from FDR through Nixon, succumbs to the temptation to use that data for political purposes, to use it to gain legislative advantage, you know, to gain strategic advantage over enemies in the legislature or opponents, to gain intelligence about other political candidates, and you know, I mean, and frankly, a lot of this information probably is of extraordinary economic value if you're picking up communications involving international finance or business deals. So there's sort of both a political and certainly a strong economic temptation because of this incredible breadth of these databases. And so we now have to trust that no one in the 20, 30 or more years that vast cache of data is sitting there will use it in anything other than a legal way.
The ACLU just filed a brief with the U.S. Supreme Court challenging the law, and the plaintiffs are interesting. They include the journalist Naomi Klein and Joanne Mariner of Human Rights Watch, a counterterrorism specialist. They argue, the ACLU does, that that the plaintiffs communicate with people who have been targets of government surveillance as part of their jobs. So it does seem to be arguably an extremely broad net, and as you say, it's there forever. Do you have any sense of, are you watching this Supreme Court challenge yourself?
Quite closely. This is Amnesty v. Clapper. This is also Amnesty International versus James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence. The trouble here is that the government is taking a very kind of clever catch-22 position. What's actually going to the Supreme Court now is not the general question of whether this law is constitutional, and certainly I think it is probably not, but the question of standing, that is, are these plaintiffs entitled to challenge the law at all? And the government kind of catch-22 argument is, well, this is highly classified secret surveillance, so of course you can't know for certain that any of your communications have been or will be wiretapped. And so because you have proof that you've actually been searched as a result of this, you are in no position to bring a challenge. You have to actually have been provably harmed by the government, as opposed to merely saying you fear that you will be harmed by this government surveillance. But of course, unlike ordinary criminal wiretaps, there is no obligation to ever notify people who have been wiretapped that they have been wiretapped. I mean, if the police tap your phone as part of a drug investigation, or they search your home as part of a drug investigation, whether they find anything or not, they are obligated to tell you after the fact that they've done this. That's not the case with intelligence surveillance, and the point is generally not to prosecute people. It's to gather intelligence, not to have a criminal trial in most cases. So the government's position is nobody can challenge this unless they can prove that they have been the victim of wiretap surveillance, and yet we are not under any obligation to ever tell anyone that they've been the target of wiretap surveillance.
But, you know, it's interesting. That would make sense, you know, if we were talking about the Fourth Amendment protections of due process. But there was that interesting case recently, a federal court judge in New York for the Southern District of New York, I believe, just upheld the standing of several plaintiffs who were challenging the National Defense Authorization Act provisions permitting indefinite detention and not making an exemption for Americans. And that lawsuit was argued on free speech grounds. And it does seem that if we're talking about monitoring communications, if the government is monitoring communications, that that could be a free speech challenge as opposed to a search and seizure.
That's absolutely right. And case. I mean, I think something the framers of the Constitution understood well. I mean, I think the First and the Fourth Amendment were understood to be mutually supporting. It was understood that without the guarantee of privacy of communication, speech would be chilled. Now, part of the issue here is that it's a little bit harder to make this a strictly speech-based argument, and traditionally the rules have been looser when you're making a speech argument than when you're making a Fourth Amendment argument. That is, the courts basically have always recognized or have long recognized the idea of a chilling effect, the idea that if you have a broad statute that censors or punishes certain kinds of speech, that the real harm of that is often not in the form of the punishment that actually is inflicted, but in the form of people being fearful and being silent and society losing the benefit of that free and open discussion. So the courts have always recognized that a chilling effect is something that counts as a harm even if you haven't actually spoken and been punished for it. There is not the same tradition of recognizing something comparable when it comes to Fourth Amendment rights to privacy. But I think, if you think of the French philosopher Michel Foucault's idea of the panopticon, the idea that the real power that violations of privacy, the real power that surveillance exercises is not necessarily the power of learning, what someone is doing, but the power of causing people to behave differently because they fear that they are being observed, whether or not they're actually under surveillance. You think of movies like the fantastic movie, The Lives of Others, about the, you see that climate of fear, the climate of not feeling able to speak your mind because you are never sure whether your words are going to be carried to a recording device of some government agent. And so it would be nice, I think, for the courts to recognize that that is an important part of the right that the Fourth Amendment protects. I mean, so the Fourth Amendment does say, it doesn't actually talk about privacy, it says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, again, reasonable searches and seizures, shall not be violated. I think it was something that they understood very well at the time that they were crafting this, that idea that this isn't just a right against searches, but a right to feel secure against searches, a right to not have to wonder whether some government agent without specific judicial authorization is going to decide to look through your papers, look through your diary, find out whether you've been saying seditious things about the government.
Julian, we're going to have to end here. Is there a place where would you like people to go if they're looking for your writing online?
Sure. I will find my stuff collected at the Cato website at www.cato.org, and you can find our blog there, and also links to papers and op-eds and other things I've written about this topic.
Thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Cheers.
We've been speaking with Julian Sanchez, a Washington, D.C.-based writer and journalist and a research fellow at the libertarian Cato Institute. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.